This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
So is there ever a time when a doctor might suggest that you get a little more salt in your diet? It probably won't come to that, but most salt sold in the U.S. contains iodine, and for women who are expecting, that's important.
No doubt that these conditions of overt hyper and hypothyroidism should be treated.
On today's Health Show, a look at thyroid issues in pregnant women.
We'll also meet the new head of a world-famous research facility in the Adirondack Mountains and hear the story of a man in China who took extreme measures to save his wife's life and got arrested. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. During the past few years, there's been a lot of discussion in both the news and in scientific literature about the merits of prenatal screening for thyroid disorders. A lot of this attention came from a study in 1999 led by Dr. James Haddow, which showed an association between an underactive thyroid gland during pregnancy and delayed neurodevelopment in a child. Well, that study begs the question, should all pregnant women be screened for hypothyroidism? Here to give some of the different points of view on that question is Dr. Anne Granowski, a professor in the Departments of Pathology and Immunology and Obstetrics and Gynecology at Washington University School of Medicine. We spoke recently, and I asked her about the importance of a mother's thyroid during pregnancy.
Well, we know that hyper, or overactive, and hypo, underactive, thyroidism can have adverse effects on the mother and her unborn baby. For instance, poorly controlled hyperthyroidism during pregnancy can lead to conditions such as congestive heart failure, thyroid storm, infection, spontaneous abortions, an increased rate of stillbirths, low birth weights, preterm delivery, fetal or neonatal hyperthyroidism, and intrauterine growth retardation. Likewise, in overt hypothyroidism, obstetrical complications such as spontaneous miscarriage, stillbirth, perinatal death, and preterm birth occur with increased frequency. In addition, the fetus can be affected by low birth weight and, in very severe cases, cretinism, which is marked by growth failure and mental retardation. Hypothyroidism can be caused by iodine deficiency, which is still a problem in certain parts of the world. So there's no doubt that these conditions of overt hyper and hypothyroidism should be treated. What has become a question is whether milder forms of hypothyroidism, referred to as subclinical hypothyroidism, should be screened for and treated.
Why do you think that this topic has gained such interest recently?
Part of it stems from Dr. Haddow's 1999 study showing an association between an underactive thyroid gland during pregnancy and delayed neurodevelopment in the offspring that you mentioned earlier. Since that time, several medical associations have created guidelines on screening and treating hypothyroidism during pregnancy, but they have differing opinions. The American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists indicate that TSH screening should be routine before pregnancy or during the first trimester. If the TSH is greater than 10 milliIU per liter, or if the TSH is between 5 and 10 milliIU per liter, and the patient has goiter or positive antithyroid peroxidase antibodies, then thyroid hormone replacement therapy should be initiated. On the other hand, the American Thyroid Association and the Endocrine Society agree that there's not enough evidence and not enough data for or against universal screening, but they also acknowledge that lack of evidence of benefit doesn't mean that there's no benefit. So they recommend only the screening of pregnant women who are at a high risk of overt hypothyroidism. In other words, patients with a history of thyroid dysfunction, thyroperoxidase antibody, or goiter. If the TSH in those patients is greater than 10, this indicates overt hypothyroidism, and thyroid hormone replacement therapy should be initiated. But if the patient has subclinical hypothyroidism, the Endocrine Society feels the potential benefits outweigh the risks, and women should be treated. The American Thyroid Association, however, says that women with subclinical hypothyroidism should be treated only if they're positive for thyroid peroxidase antibodies. However, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has recommended against screening all pregnant women for hypothyroidism and against treating subclinical hypothyroidism. They argue that there's lack of clear evidence that the identification and treatment of women with subclinical hypothyroidism will improve maternal or infant outcomes. So despite the fact that 3 out of 4 clinical guidelines recommend no screening or screening only high-risk women, experts, including the 4 that we interviewed in our article, continue to debate who, if anyone, should be screened for milder forms of thyroid disease and at what point treatment should be initiated. So clearly, more randomized controlled studies that document the safety and efficacy of intervention for both mother and infant are required before this debate is over. And in the meantime, testing and treatment remains at the discretion of the physician.
You mentioned a cause of hypothyroidism worldwide is iodine deficiency. Now, is this something we should be more concerned about?
Well, there's been a major global effort to make iodized salts available to everyone. And currently, 2/3 of the world is now covered by iodized salt. As a result, the global prevalence of children with insufficient iodine intake has fallen over the past decade. That's good. However, there has been a slight increase in the prevalence of children with insufficient iodine intake in the Americas, and the UK actually remains one of the top 10 iodine deficient countries, along with several African countries, the Russian Federation, and Afghanistan. The reasons for the decreased iodine consumption in the United States is threefold. One, our overall desire to decrease salt consumption in the United States. 2, iodized salt is not actually used in many of the fast foods and processed foods that we eat here in the United States. And 3, an increase in popular, quote-unquote, designer salts, such as sea salts and kosher salts, which usually do not contain iodine. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that people in the United States should increase their salt consumption, but it is generally agreed that pregnant and lactating women should take supplements that contain 250 milligrams of iodine per day.
Dr. Anne Gronowski is a professor in the departments of pathology and immunology and obstetrics and gynecology at Washington University School of Medicine. You can read a question and answer article on this topic in the October 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry.
For some women, pregnancy can be a factor in another thyroid disorder. According to a report from a team of researchers from the National Institutes of Health and other institutions, women who experience preeclampsia, a serious complication of pregnancy, may have an increased risk for reduced thyroid functioning later in life. Anahita Hamidi has a report.
Preeclampsia is a pregnancy condition in which high blood pressure and protein in the urine develop late in the second or third trimester. A recent study has found a link between preeclampsia and hypothyroidism, a condition in which the thyroid gland does not make enough thyroid hormone. Dr. Richard Levine is a senior investigator at the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development and served as the lead author of the study. He explains researchers found that women who had preeclampsia in more than one pregnancy were at a higher risk for hypothyroidism.
And in fact, if they had had preeclampsia in 2 successive pregnancies, their likelihood of having these high levels of thyroid stimulating hormone was much increased. So it went from about a 2-fold increase with one pregnancy with preeclampsia to a 6-fold increase with 2 pregnancies.
Preeclampsia is a life-threatening complication that occurs in 3-5% of pregnancies. Preeclampsia may begin with mild symptoms and then progress to dangerously high blood pressure and convulsions, which may result in disability or death. The only known cure for preeclampsia is delivery of the baby.
Yes, that's what everybody thinks, that when the baby is delivered, and more particularly when the placenta is removed, that all the bad things go away. But it was our idea that maybe preeclampsia left a mark that didn't go away and could lead possibly to increased risk of cardiovascular disease or kidney disease, or in this case, thyroid disease after pregnancy. And we did find that it was related to thyroid disease.
Dr. Levine says that while all the long-term effects of preeclampsia are not yet fully understood, the results of this study can still guide physicians in asking more educated questions of their patients.
I think we know enough that practicing physicians should be asking for a pregnancy history. And if a woman has had preeclampsia, she should be monitored carefully for risk factors for cardiovascular disease, for kidney disease, and for the possibility that she might have hypothyroid function.
Dr. Levine adds that the good news is hypothyroidism is easily treatable.
If the woman is symptomatic, perhaps she gets tired frequently, she doesn't have much energy, or perhaps she has elevated levels of cholesterol and so forth, it could be due to thyroid, and she could be treated with thyroxine, which is very inexpensive.
For more information regarding this study and preeclampsia, visit nichd.nih.gov. This is Anahita Hamidi, National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Still to come, our world-famous research facility in the mountains has a new leader. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1282.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. The Trudeau Institute, located in the Adirondack Mountains of northern New York in the town of Saranac Lake, was originally founded in 1884 as a tuberculosis treatment and research facility. Today, it's an independent nonprofit biomedical research organization whose stated scientific mission is to make breakthrough discoveries leading to improved human health.
The Institute's fundamental research on immunity fosters the development of vaccines, treatments, and cures for many life-threatening diseases, including cancer, tuberculosis, and influenza. The Trudeau Institute recently named a new leader for the facility. The Health Show's Pat Bradley introduces us to the new president, director, and CEO, Dr. Ronald Goldfarb.
The Board of Trustees of the Biomedical Research Institute in the Adirondacks named Dr. Ronald H. Goldfarb to lead the Trudeau Institute beginning on October 1st. Goldfarb has more than 30 years' academic and industrial experience in cancer research and co-founded a biopharmaceutical company. He has been on numerous peer review panels and scientific advisory boards and edited cancer journals. He is the Trudeau Institute's sixth president, director, and CEO.
The Institute is very well known and has a world-class reputation in immunology and immunological research. And my training is in immunology, and I've had a number of positions in my career in the immune response. And so it's a good fit for me. I'm particularly supportive of the mission of the Institute. You know, studies of the immune response help us understand how to shut down diseases, to control aging, and to combat bioterrorism. So all of these things are appealing to me. It's in an ideal position, not only as a place of physical beauty, but also, I believe, it represents the beginning of an emerging biotech cluster.
Dr. Goldfarb, the Trudeau Institute is known for its immunological research, particularly focused on the lungs. A lot of your immunological research is focused in cancer research. How does that translate or interact with what Trudeau has been doing?
Well, it's very close in many ways. And actually, the Trudeau side, the lung-based research, has had a very rich history in tumor immunology as well. But the immune response is just a remarkable approach with selectivity and specificity that has the ability to treat all types of diseases. You know, immunology is an improved and unique approach for shutting down various diseases, highly specific, as I said, and understanding the immune response will help us understand how to put together different pieces of disease progression and how it fits together and allows us to pilot a course for finding new targeted therapies for a variety of diseases, not limited to cancer. Certainly, issues of the immune response are very important in tuberculosis and other diseases. And investigators, as you probably know already, Trudeau, work in tuberculosis, work in a number of other areas where vaccinations are important, controlling aging. There's a work going on potential vaccine approaches that could protect against a variety of infections coming out of Trudeau. And there's work at Trudeau funding approaches to deal with agents that could be used in bioterrorism, and a number of other very exciting studies.
What do you see as the Institute's primary challenge in moving forward with their research?
Well, I think the major challenge is to stabilize the Institute and grow and bring in more investigators to diversify the array of areas that the immune response can be used in to attack diseases. So I'm very excited about the opportunity of buttressing and growing the Institute.
In the press release, in the announcement regarding your appointment as president, director, and CEO of the Trudeau Institute, they say that you will focus on revenue diversification strategies for the Institute. What are those strategies?
Well, that's an important question. As you know, the overall budget for science and technology in the United States has been very difficult to work within because of the economy in general. So we feel it's very important to diversify our funding stream beyond the traditional funding that many institutes such as Trudeau has enjoyed from the NIH alone. So I think that we are going to focus on pharmaceutical companies, interaction with biotechnology companies, working with the foundations associated with those companies, and also working with various angel philanthropy groups. There are all types of ways one could raise money beyond the traditional approach of only going to the NIH. And I think that it's important for Trudeau to increase its ability to do so.
You come from a research and an administrative background. When you are at Trudeau, even though they say you will be focusing on the revenue diversification strategies, basically bringing in the money that's needed for Trudeau, focused on the administrative aspects of it, do you think you'll be able to do any research? Would you like to be able to be doing research?
I have plans to do that, but not immediately. I think that as we recruit new investigators more akin to my own exact area of research, I will become more involved and set up my own laboratory as well. But that comes with time. Right now, the most important issue for Trudeau is to make certain that it's vibrant and healthy and is moving forward. And I think that until we have, to my satisfaction, the funding base in place to support all the ongoing programs and to grow, I'll put my own laboratory needs for a little bit.
Ron Goldfarb, what do you see as the potential for Trudeau Institute for its long-term future?
I think the long-term aspect of Trudeau is to have a major impact in several areas. One, for combating disease. Disease is plural. I think we could have a real impact on that, on the economic aspect of New York State, the North Country in particular. I also believe that we'll have the ability to attract companies to Saranac Lake and related areas. We think that we can work together with these companies and with other institutions in the area and really moving towards working together with all available resources to have the maximum impact on human health and protection against disease.
The Trudeau Institute was founded in 1884. Its primary research centers on the development of vaccines and treatments for diseases including cancer, influenza, and tuberculosis. Reporting for The Health Show, I'm Pat Bradley.
In his home in China, Liao Dan had a decision to make. Resign himself to the fact that his wife was going to die from kidney disease and lack of health insurance, or find a way to buck the system and save her life. So he went to the black market and had a fake health insurance card made. And it worked for 4 years. Then he got caught. Liao and his wife tell their story.
In 2007,
we found out she had kidney disease.
The doctor, who's an expert, told me, with your condition, you should have a kidney transplant. If you don't, you won't have much time left. When he said that, I cried.
She felt weak all the time, and her face and legs were bloated. She was sick, so I had to take her to a doctor. I couldn't let her die at home. I didn't think twice about it. I just wanted to make her better. She spent less than 20 days in the hospital, but that already cost more than 2,000 euros. And when she came out, she still had to keep having dialysis.
Treatments at the hospital cost 5,000 yuan a month. That's as much as we could afford in a whole year. So we were spending money all the time without having any income. By the end of the year, we'd spent all our savings, and he started to borrow money.
If I hadn't gotten the fake stamp made, I would have had to borrow the money. But it would have never been enough, and she would have died. It was on Tuesday, February 21st. I took her to the hospital for dialysis. When I took the elevator, two guys followed me. I didn't know them, so I didn't really pay attention to them. Then, when I sat down, the police came up to me, and one of them showed me his badge and said, "I'm a police officer." I knew immediately what was going on, because I knew what I had done. Then after my wife had finished her dialysis, they took me to a police station and questioned me.
When the police came to our home to get the fake stamp, I didn't know what happened. I didn't dare ask, but I was thinking, did he rob someone? Did he steal something? No.
When they came to get the stamp and saw how we were living, they said, with her condition, what else could you do?
When my son came back home from school, I told him that his father hadn't paid for my dialysis for 4 years and that he owed the hospital 150,000 yuan and that the hospital sued him and that he got arrested.
The reason I did this was that I had no choice. I wanted to save her life. What else could I do? I did wrong, and I should apologize to the hospital, and I admit that I did wrong. But whether the hospital itself or the healthcare system has made mistakes or committed wrongs too, well, you can judge that for yourself. I don't know what will happen when the legal judgment finally comes down. The hospital has already been repaid by a businessman named Mr. Chen. He said he donated the money, not because he wanted to encourage me to do something like this again, but because he hoped the court might be lenient with my sentence.
I joked about this with him. He said, if they put me away and we don't see each other again in this life, the first thing you should do is take care of our son. I said, don't worry, you just go. And then he said, in my next life, I'll never marry you because you made so much trouble for me. I replied, I wasn't sick when I married you. You treated me so well, I'll make sure I find you in the next life.
If I ever had to do it over, what would I do? Well, if the problem were the same and my wife had this disease, I would do exactly the same thing.
That report from Radio Netherlands, Jonathan Grobert.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.